my name is Tracy Melissa Wheaton, and I'm the Program Specialist and Technology Specialist for InSource. I'm here with Heather Meyer, licensed mental health counselor today, to discuss the topic of behavioral issues in special education. Good morning, Heather, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning.
First off, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what it is your agency does? I understand you have a unique approach.
Well, the approach that I use is the nurtured heart approach. I have been in the field of working with individuals with intensity and different behavioral issues and intellectual and developmental disabilities for close to 20 years. And I have used the nurtured heart approach for close to 8 years. However, in 2009, I became trained as a certified nurtured heart approach trainer. And that depth of knowledge, like, took me to a whole different level in the work that I do. And it has become my passion and the only way that I work with kids and families.
So how do you take this nurtured heart approach and parlay that into special education? In particular, I'm thinking about writing good behavior plans.
Ideally, with this approach, the teacher uses it with all students. It is a social-emotional curriculum where it's left foot, right foot, curriculum, nurtured heart approach, curriculum, nurtured heart approach. Therefore, your classroom can continue to move along without having to stop and deal with the behavior for, 20 minutes over here, and then stop and deal with an issue that's going on over here. You're creating positive and structured recognitions while you're teaching. And since at this point, Indiana does not have any teachers using this with their whole classroom, the route of going with this that I have worked with some families to do is to incorporate it into their IEPs or at least introduce it to the teachers and have them read Transforming the Difficult Child. There is also a Nurtured Heart workbook for Transforming a Difficult Child that can support that being used in the classroom. And as well as, if it is in the IEP, creating a language that's understood by those that haven't read the materials or haven't been trained in the materials to understand it so that it's in the plan. Ideally you would want the whole classroom to run it in that manner.
I love this idea of the fact that this approach works extremely well with all individuals, all children. And I love the fact that the child doesn't have to be singled out as someone, who's disrupting and then needs to be dealt with, or who is disruptive and needs to go to another room, or who is disrupted and needs to be singled out. It's something that in its most ideal form is being just sort of taught instinctively, intuitively by the teacher using it. Unfortunately, and as you had indicated earlier, Indiana doesn't have that model right now. And in the absence of that model, the best way for us to try and implement strategies that work for an intense child or child, as most people would classify as having behavior problems, behavior issues, is to do it either within the guise of the IEP or in a 504 plan. So let me put it to you like this. If a child is experiencing, quote unquote, behavior problems at school, where is it that the parent should begin the process?
Well, it starts first with developing the relationship with the teacher, and having an open door of communication. I think there are parents that get really frustrated with schools at times. Yet, you know, we also have teachers that have big classrooms with different special needs, and you know, that adds a whole level of stress for them. So I just, you know, developing that relationship and respect for one another, that we're in this together, and what can we do for Johnny? You know, that's the start. And at the point that, you know, if a child does qualify for an IEP or, you know, a 501, then, you know, calling for a meeting, to be able to sit around the table to problem solve and determine, you know, what's next, what needs to happen.
I mean, what is it that constitutes an emotional disability or a behavior problem? I mean, my daughter, for example, has ADHD. You know, probably has some other things going on, but I'm not especially anxious to label her any more than I absolutely have to, because I'm a big believer in moving away from that sort of deficit kind of thinking, because it once we start putting labels on kids, it's really hard for us to see the good in them. And as you know, these kids that are intense personalities often have lots and lots of really wonderful, wonderful stuff underneath. And I worry that, you know, labeling kids, and I'm getting way off track here, but that labeling children with various disabilities, although it helps us get the kids the supports they need in school, I mean, it's a tool, a vehicle for getting us what we need to help the children. It also, I think in many ways, makes it really difficult for us to see them for something other than their disability. In other words, their label, they become their label, and when in fact, they are anything but that in reality. But all that having been said, what is it, you know, knowing that the child has to have some criteria in order to meet the label of emotional disability, can you explain a little bit of what would constitute an emotional disability? We talk about ADHD as being one. Throw some labels at me, Heather, and I know this is like so contrary to your nature.
ADHD, you know, you got oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, you know, you've got sometimes kids are getting the label of, you know, early onset bipolar disorder. Those would be, you know, some of the more common ones. I think some kids are even getting just impulse control disorder. You know, it in the schools, it, you know, to have an emotional disability, it's usually that, you know, the child has an inability to learn, that, you know, it's not because of any medical reason, or it's not because of an intellectual reason, but there's some inappropriate behaviors that are going on, that they're not responsive to the typical approach. You know, their inner personal skills with the, you know, other kids or the teacher are not going well. You know, they have trouble with relationships, and then they may even like become avoidant or create issues and start having physical symptoms. So that would be some of the criteria that schools would look at. And, you know, to comment upon what you're saying about labels, yeah, it's unfortunate that it seems that at this point we need labels to get that support. The beautiful thing about the Nurtured Heart approach is that with the approach, when the right interventions are put into place, when the right structure is put into place, the behaviors tend to disappear. The need for medication declines. And then what ends up happening is, you know what, it really wasn't pathology to begin with. You know, if we can, you know, surround, you know, a child and give them what they need to flourish with whatever, you know, whatever intensities that they have, because, you know, intensities does not have to be seen as a handicap. Then it just creates a whole another level, another playing field. And, you know, in many school districts around the country, you know, with implementing this approach into the classrooms, there's actually been kids that get moved out of the special education classes, or they're able to be included in other classes. So you can grow out of having to be in that label that holds you back.
I love that. I love that. And I love to think that someday, and I know that someday my daughter will be will be in that position. And it makes me happy to think about it. What I think I hear you saying is that, all right, you need a label. Let's go ahead. Let's get the label so that we can get on with the business of helping the child. How do we do that? Is that done? Do we assess those behaviors? I mean, is there a formal structure, a functional behavioral assessment, or how is it that the school goes about making this determination that, yes, indeed, the child does, in fact, have an emotional disability?
Well, that begins with doing a functional behavioral assessment, and that assessment, it's typically stated that a psychologist does it, but my understanding is that sometimes other personnel in the school system will do the assessment. But what the use of that is to gather data so that you can identify the patterns and the functions of the behavior. And, you know, so you have a starting point of where to go. It answers, you know, why is this happening? And you know, what so that we can really get a good picture to know what we need to do. And, you know, this evaluation should include not only interviews with the teachers, but observations and, you know, rating scales, actual assessment tools. All three of those components should be included. And you're looking at the full scope of the child. You're looking at the social developmental history. You're looking at the mental health and medical path, their motor and sensory abilities, their communication skills, their academics, their cognitions. You're looking at that full picture of the child. And then once you have the outcome of that, then that is where you then are able to, you know, build your behavior plan. And there are cases that sometimes those assessments aren't showing that there is an issue or a disability that's interfering with the child's learning. And, you know, I would encourage, you know, those parents that, because then you're not getting the support that you need at the school. If you come across that, you know, you get an outside consultation.
Okay. Yeah, that is helpful, because I've known it to happen on a number of occasions for whatever reason. A school may not feel that the child has any kind of behavioral issues or anything that's impeding progress in the classroom, and the parent may, you know, completely disagree. At that point, I know that the parent has the right to ask for another evaluation be done outside of the school, and typically the schools have a list of providers that can do that, or the parent can go to the place of their choice, have one done, and then ask that the school accept those results, although I know many times the schools are loath to do that. But now, I've seen kids with behavioral, quote-unquote, behavioral issues have both 504s or, I should say, have either a 504 plan or an IEP. Why do some get 504s and some get IEPs?
You know, and because I'm not an expert in educational law, all I can give is my hypothesis, which, you know, typically, the way that I have seen it is if you have, the label of mental retardation, you're more likely to have emotional disability. Whereas a 504, you might academically you could be doing okay if you could get your behavioral stuff under control.
Now, are there typical types of behavior plans? Are there specific behavior plans? Do all behavior plans look alike? Are they supposed to be customizable? How does that work, Heather?
Well, behavior plans should be individualized, within what can occur in the classroom. but you know, they all should have similar components. You know, if you're working with a child that has, you know, autism, you may look at that differently than, you know, a lot of their behaviors are going to, it might be sensory, you know, sensory issues, or, you know, a dysregulation issue, you know, so that they might need some more environmental sort of supports. Whereas, you know, if you've got someone else who's just kind of, you know, they're attention seeking because they're looking for the energy, you know, from their teacher, to get relationship.
When you're looking at a behavior plan for a student, what are the key things you look for? I mean, what in your mind makes for a good behavior plan?
Well, a good behavior plan. Well, you know, because, you know, everything needs to be measurable. You know, you want to, first you want to make sure that you are clearly outlining the child's strengths, you know, cause that's the focus, because that's what you want to build upon are those strengths. And, you know, the team needs to really work together to identify those. And then secondly, what are those targeted behaviors, and what are what was the function of those behaviors? You know, you want to reference your functional behavior assessment. And then with the target behaviors, you know, you want to name them and name the baseline data, and, you know, how often they're occurring, the frequency, the intensity, you know, is it the off the hook intensity, you know, is it high or is it low? And then, you know, the duration, you know, how long are these situations lasting? You know, that gives you your starting point, so you know where you're going and what your goal is of achieving, which, yes, you also want to have your goal of what you want to accomplish. So what is also important is you want to know what the triggers are, and, you know, so that the teacher can identify what they need to change. You know, what modifications they need to give, whether it's in, you know, environmental modifications, or, you know, whether that's, you know, time for a sensory diet, you know, for a child, or, you know, what strategies, teaching strategies, for new skills need to be put in place. So the replacement behavior needs to be clearly identified. And then what strategies the teacher is going to use to achieve those outcomes. And then another component would be the, you know, how are you going to reinforce those replacement behaviors? How are you going to reinforce, you know, what greatness that child is showing? If things do go wrong, what steps need to go in place before we go more restrictive? I think all those things are important from the get-go of wherever you are in your IEP, to make sure that you're discussing all those things, you know, to support success, so that things don't have to go more restrictive, and we're working towards the positive.
Thank you for explaining it. And that was actually a nice dovetail into my next question, which is, to what extent is the school required to go to before determining if a more restrictive environment is, at least in their estimation, necessary?
When we take a child out of the classroom, or even if we take them down to the principal's office, and we're not working with that child in the classroom, it's, what message does that deliver to the child? What message?
Right.
You can't handle your intensity. Well, I can't handle your intensity. Well, the principal can't handle your intensity. So, okay, we're going to put you over here. And so it's, you know, we're the adults that child's looking up to for guidance. And so we have to be able to say, I can handle your intensity, and I'm going to help you learn how to handle yours. And that the nurtured heart approach really, really, really is able to create that within the classroom.
Yeah. Thank you again for touching back on that nurtured heart approach. So much of a school's approach to a child's behavior is based kind of in that realm of deficit thinking, and, you know, emphasizing always what the child lacks in terms of self-control. And I'd like to switch gears again just for a minute, and kind of talk about reinforcement of positive behaviors, if we could. Could you please tell us why a child's success depends upon reinforcement of positive behaviors more than it does anything else?
Well, you know, I think all of us want to know we're doing well. And ultimately, we're social creatures. Everything that we do every single day is all about relationship. Either we're like, holy crap, I don't know what to do. And we back off and we're like, because I'm scared because of what's going on with that relationship, or I want more of you and I'm going to do whatever I can to get your attention. And so when we look at it from a place of relationship, we want to help kids feel safe, and we want to help them feel valued and loved and respected and heard, just like we all ourselves want to be, you know, treated and felt, you know, as valuable and respectable and loved. And so the importance is that, you know, it's a tough world. It's a tough world for all of us. We all need to have tools to help ourselves regulate and calm so that we can be clear to learn and to interact. You know, when we're, you know, flying high with our nervousness and our overwhelmed and stressed out selves, it's challenging to function. And it's that way for kids today. That it, you know, home life is tough, and, you know, you got media and you've got computers and everything so fast paced. You know, what we need to do is value, because everything takes effort for a child that has intensities. Just to sit still sometimes for 3 minutes is a huge deal for a kid when there's all kinds of stuff going on. So effort should be reinforced. You know, recognize for when, you know, I've got a kid that I worked with that he his fists would get all tight and his whole body'd start shaking and he'd be staring at me, and I know what's next. What comes next is something's probably gonna, you know, he's gonna whack me or something's gonna get thrown. But in that moment, I have an opportunity to reward his success, because in that moment, I love that right now, even though you're so frustrated, you have not thrown anything. You're handling yourself. I see that you're concentrating right now, and you're keeping your cool. That's awesome self-control. So before he blows, I am recognizing that he's got himself together. You know what happens? His hands open up and he looks at me. and so then in the next moment, I can say, I see that you're listening to me right now. That's great. Can we get back on task? And he'll say, whatever, you know, yeah, okay, all right, great. And then in the next moment when he's participating, I can recognize his success. There are so many opportunities that we have in the moment to see things through a different lens. And, you know, what has happened, we rather than focusing on the problem, because when we focus on the problem, it just gets bigger. And it's almost like, you know, I think the way... First off, we're all critical thinkers. You know, I think that especially, you know, when you're teaching, that's how you get improvement. You're critically looking at what's going on. But what we want to do is not create relationship around the problems and focus on the problems. We want to create relationship around what's going well. And changing our definition of what's going well, as I said in that example, when, you know, the kid looks like he's ready to blow, he hasn't blown, he's still got it together, and that's the difference with this approach too.
Heather, thank you so much for explaining that in such great detail. Is there a number or a way our listeners who might be interested in talking with you further about this might be able to reach you?
Yes, I do have a website forthcoming, but in the next couple of weeks, it'll be up. It'll be live in the next couple of weeks. But for now, you can contact me at Heather Meyer. It's M-E-Y-E-R at dynamicwisdom.net. And my phone number is 317-603-0995.
Okay, so that's Heather Meyer at dynamicwisdom.net. And I would encourage any of our listeners that are interested in contacting Heather to please do so through that email address. Heather Meyer, many kind thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the InSource podcast. The views expressed on this podcast are the views of the person being interviewed and not necessarily the views of InSource.
Yeah, and the key really is, I mean, what happens with this approach and is that it is more than a parenting technique, and it's more than a behavior management plan. It really is, it's a lifestyle shift to how you view things, and it just changes the lens on how you see things. You yourself as a parent, you yourself as a person become transformed, and it changes all your interactions with everyone. And in using the actual techniques and the language, and then the energy that you put behind the language when it comes from heart, it's amazing what unfolds. It's astonishing. It seems like the simplicity of the approach couldn't possibly